Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Mrs. Sylvia Panetta.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the second event of the 16th season of the Leon Panetta Lecture Series. This year, our theme is Gridlock or Action. Leon and I are strong believers in the promise and power of our democracy, and have always been. That's why we started the Panetta Institute and specifically this lecture series. The test of our democracy is to govern the nation to solve its problems. Today, Washington is clearly failing that test. We seem to move from crisis to crisis without seeing bipartisan leadership or consensus. Threats are made, commissions are formed, and recommendations are given, but no action is taken. We hear promises about working together, but gridlock truly rules the day. We spoke hopefully last month about opportunities for consensus on immigration reform. But as you know, even there, recent headlines suggest trouble. Even in the wake of the Newtown tragedy and 90% public support for background checks, Congress failed to do anything. Perhaps no issue defines the partisan dysfunction in Washington more than the budget. From fiscal cliffs to the debt ceiling crises to tragic gimmicks like the sequester, our nation's most vital fiscal decisions are delayed. Time and time again, they are delayed. Each party blames the other, but it is America that is paying the price for this failure to govern. Will we ever see leadership instead of crisis? Can our leaders rise above partisan gridlock to serve the best interest of the American people and the fiscal health of our nation? Can politicians move beyond finger-pointing and playing the blame game? Tonight, we'll discuss this vital issue with two of the smartest political commentators in Washington. Both have been Leon's guests before, and I know their conversation will be lively, challenging, and thought-provoking. Our first guest is a panelist on Fox News Sunday and the founder and editor of the influential Washington-based political magazine, The Weekly Standard. He served as chief of staff to Education Secretary William Bennett during the Reagan administration, and then as chief of staff to Vice President Dan Quayle. Known for his advocacy of a strong American foreign policy, he was a columnist for Time magazine and the New York Times, and now writes a guest commentaries for the Washington Post. Today, he is widely recognized as one of the nation's leading political analysts and commentators. Bill is a returning guest to the Leon Panetta Lecture Series, and we are so pleased he has been able to join us again. Please welcome William Crystal.
Welcome.
Thank you. Our second guest is one of America's best-known political consultants. His political campaign successes began in 1986 when he managed the gubernatorial victory of Robert Casey in Pennsylvania. Following several other winning campaigns, he helped guide Bill Clinton to the presidency in 1992 and was named Campaign Manager of the Year by the American Association of Political Consultants. He has gone on to advise international clients such as the Liberal Party of Canada, then Brazilian President Fernando Henrique Cardoso, and then Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak. The best-selling author of several books, including All's Fair, Love, War, and Running for President, which he co-authored with his wife, Mary Madeline, and his most recent book, It's the Middle Class, Stupid, co-authored with pollster Stan Greenberg, this Ragin' Cajun is known for his sharp tongue and his sharp analysis. Please welcome back, indeed, James Carville. Thank you. Finally, leading our discussion is the former congressman for the Central Coast and founder of the Panetta Institute and indeed this lecture series. In addition to his leadership at the CIA and Department of Defense, he also led the way towards a balanced budget as chairman of the House Budget Committee, director of the Office of Management and Budget, and chief of staff in the Clinton administration. Incidentally, please remember that was the last time we had a balanced budget. Please welcome our moderator, Secretary Leon E. Panetta.
Thank you very much.
I think if you ran, you would win, Leon.
The real question is, would I need you?
I'm mucking up for you.
Welcome, everybody. It's great to have you join us for this second forum that we're having this year on the issue of the overall theme is gridlock versus action. I think it's fair to say that all three of us have spent a lot of time in Washington. We've seen Washington at its best, and we've seen Washington at its worst. It's my view, at least, that at least in the time that I've spent in Washington on and off over the last 50 years, that I've never seen Washington as partisan and as dysfunctional as it is right now. Everybody seems to be throwing up their hands. The president basically says that he can't get the Republicans to behave. The Republicans say that the president won't budge. As a result, very little is being accomplished. I guess the first question for both of you is, why is Washington as dysfunctional as it is right now?
Sure. James?
Let me try.
I
really
dysfunctions.
I've given a bunch of, you hear a lot of standard things. I have this new idea why Washington is kind of dysfunctional. I know this is my feeling, and I think I really speak for Billy and Secretary Panetta. We love politics. And a lot of people that come to Washington today run against it, and they come there and they think it's like a dirty business. And there's something wrong with just sitting there and having drinks and writing things out on the back of a napkin, an envelope, or calling each other and socializing. And just to integrate it, they view politics as something that they're doing, but they really don't like it, they don't love it, they're not into it. And I just tell you, my whole life, I was always glad I was in politics. And most of the people from either party, and I think when you listen, you watch Bill on television, and you watch him talk about it, he likes to engage in it. He actually likes politics. And a lot of people come there, and they don't have the lust for it. They think that they're engaging in something that's unseemly, and that's just the way it works. And anybody that saw that Lincoln movie was like, I mean, it was just how hard it is to get something done. Like, you just were going to win the war. You just wanted to get rid of slavery, which had done in Britain, years and years before. And to actually do this is really hard work. And if you don't love it and live it every day, the easiest thing to do is just throw up your hands and say, I can't deal with these people anymore. And I think that to some extent, you know, I thought about this a lot today, to some extent, I think that is a little bit of the culprit. So if you ever vote, and you vote for somebody, if they say, I don't like politics, I don't like this whole thing, they're not going to be very good at their job. You wouldn't hire a doctor that didn't want to be a doctor. They didn't like nothing. I said, man, I just don't like sticking my hands where it's good God, or, you know. No, that's not what you want. You want somebody, why do we think that we want politicians to represent us that hate what they do? And yet, that's what we're sort of told by a lot of people out of there. So I think that's part of it.
Bill?
Well, first of all, thanks, Leon and Sylvia, for having me back in this beautiful area and for this fair and balanced discussion here. It's good. I'm James is a liberal. I'm a conservative. I speak English. It's a tribute to you that they don't have the translator up here, you know, for James. It's a sophisticated audience, you know, university town. I don't know. You know, you could say, and with some truth, that every 5, 10, 20 years, people say, oh, the dysfunction's worse than ever, and somehow America muddles through. And I think you could make the case today that, in fact, on some of the key issues, it's not as dysfunctional as people think. I mean, in 2008, when we had the horrible financial meltdown, not expected really by either party, and for which both parties, I think, bear some responsibility, the truth is there was bipartisanship after one go-round where the bailout failed, for the bailout and then for the auto bailout. On the key foreign policy issues, I mean, when you were Secretary of Defense and CIA Director before that, there actually was more bipartisanship than people realize. On Afghanistan, a lot of Republicans who don't trust President Obama nonetheless supported the surge. And on the war on terror, I think President Obama has continued more of the Bush policies than expected. So I think when stuff's really on the line, people pull together. The trouble, in a way, has been, oddly enough, that on the budget, the issue of concern to us and so much of a concern to you throughout your career, we haven't really paid a price for the lack of cooperation. The truth, the economy's not great, but it's been coming back since 2009. It's better than most other industrialized countries. It's hard to prove that it'll be doing better if there were a budget deal. We're not paying much of a price for the debt or the deficit yet. And so both parties, which have pretty strongly differing views on what should be done, have been able to hold the line. I think if there really were a crisis, there would be much more of a sense of urgency of making a deal, but there hasn't been one yet, which is not a bad thing in a way, but it is true that we therefore do kick the can down the road.
James, let me ask you something with regards to the president. Maureen Dowd in the New York Times had a column in which she referred to the president in his press conference suggested that it was not his job to get Republicans to behave. And Dowd said, actually, it is his job to get them to behave. It's called leadership. And she went on to say that even the impression of weakness begets weakness. Should the president be doing more?
You know, I voted for the president both times. I contributed to him. I think he's made a lot more good decisions than bad. He's for better or worse, he's a guy that doesn't get down in the trenches. And he never has. That's just never been the way that he does things. And I think in his view, I've got trying to speak for him, but I think his view is, I set out good, reasonable policies that are well thought out. I send them up to the Hill, and they need to sort this out. But, I mean, he does not get on the phone. He doesn't horse trade. He doesn't. Now, one of the things that we were talking about earlier today is when we got rid of earmarks, we really cut down on the ability of people to sort of get things done. It was, I think, the percent of GDP that earmarks represented was infinitesimal. And its ability to move people along was really pretty significant. But if this is that's not the president's style, and I think Marine or other people like prefer a more activist, hands-on guy to do that, and he probably takes the view at some level. He's a con law professor. Look, I'm the executive branch. I send stuff up. The legislative branch deals with it as they see fit. That clearly what I want to do is sort of laid out here. I think that's a fair observation. Most people look at that and say that's kind of who this president sort of is. He's not a guy that goes in for the sort of backslapping and, you know, log rolling and in the normal back and forth of politics. And whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, I'll leave it up to you. My former boss, you couldn't get him off the phone with people. He was like, the best line about Bill Clinton was, is that somebody in Arkansas once said he could talk a dog out of a pork chop. So I don't think her column was totally unfair, but I think that's kind of who the president is.
Bill?
I mean, as a conservative who didn't vote for Barack Obama twice, I mean, I think it's a little unfair in this sense. He, from his point of view, it's not like he's not gotten a lot done. Mm-hmm. I mean, he did Obamacare. I think it's a bad idea, and I hope ultimately it is repealed. But nonetheless, it is what liberals have been trying to do for 30, 40, 50 years, really, since Truman. He got it through the House and the Senate and signed it, despite all kinds of obstacles being put in his way, despite losing that special election in Massachusetts when Scott Brown won in January of 2010. He did the stimulus. Maybe some liberals now think it should have been bigger, but at the time, it was by far the biggest thing that had ever been done by the federal government, $850 billion of spending. He has a view of foreign policy that I don't agree with in large part, but nonetheless, he's pursued that pretty systematically. It got us out of Iraq and is now drawing down in Afghanistan. I mean, I think you could say from his point of view, he's got the economy. Again, I think it could grow faster, but nonetheless, compared to other leaders in the Western world, whether in Britain or France or even Germany, actually, certainly, you know, well, really most industrialized nations, he can sit back and think, you know, I took over a pretty bad situation, and I pursued the policies I thought were right, and I've gotten enough of them through that I, you know, I'm willing to be judged on those. Now, we'll see what he can do now over the next 3 years. That is a big test. Second terms are very tough, and I do think he's not off to I think as with President Bush in 2005, who got reelected by a similar sort of 51% of the vote, he may have overread his margin and his mandate. Bush actually controlled both houses of Congress in 2005. President Obama didn't succeed in taking back the House. Whether he could have done things a little differently right after the election, focused on a few things, really gone to the Republicans, really worked them hard, tried to go around the leadership if the leadership wasn't strong enough, wasn't willing to cooperate. It's hard to tell. I mean, it's a different world also, obviously, from the world of the 80s or the 90s in terms of the party structures and the members of Congress. The Republicans in the House, you know, half of them have been elected in the last three elections. And they don't think their constituents sent them there to cut deals with President Obama. And, you know, it's fair enough. They ran against him. They promised they would stand up to Obama. So they don't feel... And again, if there were a crisis, they would say, oh, well, I promised that, but now we have to come to the negotiating table. But in some sense, absent being forced to do this by the financial markets, they sort of feel they're doing more, they're being more honorable, I'd say, and more true to their campaign promises by fighting a lot of what the president wants to do rather than working with him, except on foreign policy, where I think they have been pretty responsible.
Yeah, they did out ahead. You say, look, up Ice Bin Laden, auto industry, and, you know, went against a lot of advisors, and the banks, the deficit of center GDP has had the best 3 years we've had in a long time. The stock market is better than it's ever been, is up a gazillion points have been present. What else you guys want? I mean, what, do you want me to log roll it on the phone? Yeah. Boom.
Let me, turning from the president to Congress, you touched on it a little bit. You know, as you know, and it was a different time, but when I was there, Tip O'Neill, Bob Michael, Bob Dole, George Mitchell, Howard Baker, when we were doing the budgets at that time, they basically said, even though they had their political differences, they said, we've got to do this. We're going to put you in a room, you're going to negotiate, and you're not going to come out of the room until you got a deal. And the leadership basically was strong enough to require that we do that. In a recent column, you wrote about the new normal, and let me just quote some lines from it. The new normal for GOP leaders who are once terrified and contemptuous of their own base, equally intimidated by donors and voters, but uninterested in treating either group as grown-ups, think that they too can simply shelter in place, unquote. Why is the present leadership unable or unwilling to really push their members?
I think it's hard controlling only one House of Congress. It's not an accident that the budget deals of 90 and when you were in the House and then of 97 when you were the president with the president were Congress was controlled by one party, both houses, and then the president was of the other party. So you could have sort of a negotiation among equals. It's a little harder when you control only one house, as the Republicans do. It's a sort of uneven negotiation. Your members always think, therefore, you're about to be taken to the cleaners, so they tend to revolt at the first sign of any kind of compromise. So I think John Boehner, who is the only Republican who's the Republican in Washington who would have to cut the deal ultimately, has a very tough job. But I also think that I think it's my criticism of them in this term is they're not, I mean, they should take more of a lead in the House, I think, in doing some things that they could be doing. And the problem is they can't do the big things they want to do. They're not going to have a Republican type of tax reform when President Obama is president. They're not going to repeal Obamacare when President Obama is president. They're not going to repeal Dodd-Frank when Barack Obama is president. That doesn't mean, in my view, that they couldn't do something for the community banks that I think are getting clobbered by Dodd-Frank. It doesn't mean they couldn't do certain things on Obamacare that would, I think, improve the situation for health care and not lock Obamacare in place. But they've sort of talked themselves into an all-or-nothing theory, which is unfortunate, I think, and a mistake in their case. I'll give you one little example. This is medical device tax in Obamacare, 2.3% excise tax, not on profits, but on revenues of medical device companies. Very foolish tax, in my opinion, since this is an American field in which American companies are leaders in many areas. And it's just not even say not a tax on profits, but a tax on revenues, which is kind of crazy, but it pays for some of Obamacare. When the Senate was considering the budget, by I think 77 to 19, with bipartisan support, obviously, the Senate passed an amendment to the budget calling for the repeal of the medical device tax. It doesn't have legal authority. It's just the budget resolution. So I said to a senior Republican in the House, you're the House. You do have a majority. Republicans have hated this tax from the beginning because they don't like most of Obamacare. Why don't you just pass the repeal of the tax and send it over to the Senate? And then it's Harry Reid won't want to do it, but he has 77 votes on record for it. Oh, no, we're holding back. We're going to do big tax reform later this year or early next year. And, I mean, it's a reasonable wish to have a big tax reform, but in my view, it's not going to happen. And they've sort of, and the same with Dodd-Frank. They want to repeal Dodd-Frank instead of helping out in particular ways. I think they may be moving off this a little bit now, but they've talked themselves into sort of two grandiose hopes. So they oscillate between, we're going to do huge things, and we can't do anything. No. And I think Boehner sort of has coming to the realization, but he's got to bring a lot of his members around, too, that there are some bite-sized things they can do that are substantively in accord with Republican principles, and also I think would actually be politically smart to do.
James, we went through a November election, and obviously President Obama won pretty handily over Mitt Romney.
I wish you wouldn't have brought that up. That was really good. It's 6 months ago. We've moved on, really. You know?
It seems that way. A majority of the American people, by virtue of their vote, seem to indicate that, they sided with Obama, at least on many of the issues. And yet we come into the second term, and he can't get any kind of, background check enacted. He's pushed around on sequester. He has to basically cave in on the exceptions on sequester. Even on immigration reform, everybody seems to be for it, still running into problems there. And on the budget, nothing is happening. Are there no consequences to a national election?
Well, first of all, but the tax rates went up about people over 400,000 up to the Clinton number. My guess is that the background checks is going to get out to Senate. I think this thing is coming back, and I think it's going to pass. On immigration, but I think there's going to be an immigration bill that gets to the Senate. Now, what happens to get to the House, I don't know. But there are a lot of Republicans, a lot more Republicans are talking about immigration now than before the election. I mean, you're hearing a whole sort of, now when the rubber hits the road, what happens, I'm not sure. But I said on Bill Maher the night after the election that there was the Saturday after the election, in the South, they kind of say, sometimes to get that boy's attention, you have to hit him upside the head with a 2x4. And I think what you heard on election night was pine on skull. Now, if they're going to be faced with an electorate in 2016 that is going to be even more unfavorable to them than the electorate they faced in 2012, then this is never going to stop. In one day, the whole math is going to dawn on people. Now, I wrote a book about it in 2009. We immediately lost the election in 2010. But off years are different than presidential years. And my guess is you'll see some sort of change. But the Republican House has a different kind of agenda than the president does, and to some extent a different kind of agenda than the Senate does. And that's just the kind of nature of politics, is the way that the country has sorted out. So I do think that there's been
a change. I think that we're going to be much closer votes than we ever had on both background checks and immigration. Now, whether it gets to the House or not, I'm not good enough to predict that.
Yeah, no, the election, as I said, which you unfortunately reminded us of, I didn't hear what James heard on election night because I was drunk myself into a stupor, but nonetheless, I'm sure it was a very interesting evening for after Virginia went down around 9:30 p.m., but... No, and look, in fact, Republicans correctly, I think, caved on top rates. James's taxes were raised, and that was good for the country. And that was one of the main things, one of the main differences between the parties. And of course, Obamacare is now here for the next 4 years, unless it just becomes such a train wreck that he has to deal with it. And other things that Republicans would have changed haven't been changed. I mean, he's an incumbent running for re-election, so it's probably unrealistic to expect a huge new spurt of activity. And look, some of his ideas, I think he just, I mean, you think he might have brought back up card check, which the labor unions want so much, climate change, which the environmentalists believe in so much. But I think he decided after trying those in 2009, 2010 with a Democratic Congress, he wasn't going to get it through a Republican House. I do think just as a tactical matter, it's understandable that he believes in the gun control agenda, the part of it that he advanced. Newtown was obviously a terrible tragedy, and he thought there was a chance to do it. I think it was a tactical mistake. It got off. He got his second term off on an issue that no one had talked about during the campaign that wasn't really central to his agenda. And honestly, even if the bill were passed, it wouldn't affect a crime at all, in my opinion. And instead of, you know, the kind of economic growth, jobs type agenda, where I think he would have had a lot of clout after defeating Mitt Romney, that sort of has receded. Immigration is something worth doing. I'm not sure about the current bill, but in principle, I think moving ahead in some form of immigration reform is worth doing. Though, again, it's not clear that... It's just surprising when you have 7.5% unemployment, slow growth, that the reelected president's first item isn't some kind of growth or jobs agenda. And I think that may have been a mistake.
Let me ask you something, because, you know, I think we were talking about this earlier. If in the House, most members are not worried about the November election, but are worried about their primary election. And so Republicans are going to be worried about their right, and Democrats are going to be worried about their left. If what I'm saying is true, then how do you get people that are appealing to the extremes to compromise when they think it's not going to impact on their election?
Look, and some of it is sought, some of it is gerrymandered. I mean, in California, basically, when they did the redistricting, they protected the incumbents. I mean, you could have. I don't know the exact number, but there are probably very few people in California like your old district where you had to worry about the general. You had to come home. You had to politic. You actually had to work the general election. There's fewer and fewer, and that happens over and over again. Now, a lot of it is just that all, by and large, most of the Democrats live in the cities. The Republicans don't. I pointed out to the young people today, this is something most people don't realize. If Romney would have split the vote in three counties, Broward County, Florida, Philadelphia County, Pennsylvania, and Cuyahoga County, Ohio, he would have won the Electoral College. That's how many Democrats live in cities. If you did California, which is an overwhelmingly blue state, and you took out, you know, Los Angeles County and probably San Diego is what is San Francisco out there? What's the second biggest populous county in California? Whatever. If you probably took out Los Angeles County.
Huh? Bay Area.
Yeah. But if you just took out Los Angeles County, you would probably be pretty close to being a 50-50 state. But that's a lot of people. And a lot. And that trend, there were three, I'll take a few minutes on this. There were some important moments in presidential electoral history. The first was in 1968 when Kevin Phillips, who, by the way, just wrote a pretty good book on the American Revolution, talked about the emerging Republican majority that people would, and he was right. The Republicans went from 1968 to 1988 by losing only one election. And then
a very important thing happened after the 2000 election. Matthew Dowd wrote a memo saying that elections were not won in the center. They were won by appealing that you really won big presidential elections by getting your own people out. Because the way that we used to do it is, if you were a Democrat, you ran as far as you had to the left to get the nomination. As soon as you got it, you go, oh, no, man, just, you know, let's move back to the center. Dowd said, and that had an important effect on Republican strategic doctrine, that the way that you ran it is getting the base. And it, basically, that's the way they ran in 2004 and won, and to that extent, it validated that. Then in 2003, Rui Teixeira and John B. Judas wrote a book called The Emerging Democratic Majority, which, of course, after the Democrats lost in 2004, people mocked. But then after the election of 2012, these guys became predictive geniuses. The other thing is, I'll give myself credit, in 2009 I pointed out that young voters were turning overwhelmingly Democratic. Mm-hmm. One of the most interesting things about this past election is that Cubans under 30 split in Florida 50-50. Romney carried whites under 30 by 8 points, carried whites over 65 by 30 points or whatever. More than that, actually, probably four. No, 20, about like 25. I'm sorry. So I mean that there are underlying shifts that are going on that people have to sort of deal with as presidential politics goes off into the future.
No.
But I mean, you asked sort of why the president hasn't in a way been able to do more, having been reelected. And I really do think, honestly, if you were chief of staff and James were there in the White House and he were listening to you guys, he could have done more. And I'm frankly, as a conservative, somewhat happy that he hasn't done more. It's not as if Boehner has they control the Senate. There's a 60-vote margin, but the truth is, if you can get all the Democrats together, which they couldn't do after all on the gun bill, it puts a lot of pressure on the Republicans from states that President Obama carried, and there are a bunch of Republicans from Maine and Illinois and states, Pennsylvania, who would feel under pressure, especially soon after an election. In the House, it's not as if Boehner has total control. Three bills passed the House soon after, in the very beginning of January, in which which were passed by almost all the Democrats and a minority of Republicans, which the Speaker couldn't stop or didn't choose to stop from coming to the floor. The tax increase for the wealthy, the Hurricane Sandy Relief Act, which had a lot of non-Hurricane Sandy-related pork added to it, but in any case, and the Violence Against Women Act, which had been a sort of priority of the president. And I do think, honestly, if he hadn't then sort of decided to do gun control and somehow not push other parts. He also is a little bit, I think, like what I was saying about Boehner earlier and the Republicans. He wants to have a grand bargain, I guess, or at least the media has told him he should try to have a grand bargain. And as a result, I'm sort of surprised he hasn't pushed a lot of medium-sized bills, had Harry Reid push them through the Senate if he could, put a lot of pressure on those moderate Republicans, and then put pressure on Boehner in the House. I think, honestly, if he were Lyndon Johnson or if he were Bill Clinton, he would have had much more legislation passed. As a conservative, I'm not that unhappy about this, but I think here, to get back to your earlier question, his somewhat removed style, his lack of interest in real legislative horse trading, I think has hurt him. He could be further along here, and he's at some risk now, 6 months into his second, 4 months into his second term, I think, of dissipating the momentum you have. He was reelected president. The Democrats picked up 2 Senate seats. They picked up, 6-8 House seats. They clearly had the wind at their back. Republicans were in total meltdown those first few weeks. You know, we'd never win an election again. All the young people were against us, all this. And he really could have put pressure on. And in a way, he's let the pressure off probably more than, just from a tactical point of view, more than he should have.
Let me ask you about that, both of you. It comes out of the election. He obviously has the Republicans in somewhat of a box on the tax issue. The taxes are expiring. He's got pressure on them not to just continue all of the tax cuts, but to hold back on the tax cuts, raise the rates on the rich. At that point, it seems to me, I mean, look, every budget deal that I've been a part of, as I said, includes entitlement savings, discretionary caps, and revenues. Why, at that point, if he knew that he had the Republicans in a box on the tax side, should he not have put entitlements on the table and made the big deal?
He did.
But why didn't he make the big deal?
He put JCPI on the table. He's put Medicare cuts on the table. He's put all of this on the table. They're not going to do it. He could put anything he wanted, but he put all of this in. But they look, The average Republican looks at Boehner and they said, oh, God, don't let him go to the negotiation. He's going to get his clock clean. An average Democrat is like, Obama's sitting there negotiating with himself. What's he doing? He's caving before that. But he puts this, he puts it there and they're not. Now, I do think, I think Obama really wants the grand bargain. He wanted, just basically offered the whole thing to him in 2011. I really believe that he believes that will seal his legacy if he gets that. I think he probably knows that we'll get it before 2014, but in the last 2 years. Maybe it's something that can happen. Is a grand bargain a good idea? Well, it depends on what's in the grand bargain, and it depends on who you are. It's an abstract idea. And yes, it will include entitlement cuts, it'll include revenue increases, it'll include something in defense. Well, it depends on how much and where. And so that we don't know. But he has put out all of to some Democrats, why don't you just hold back and sort of play a, the Democrats don't think he's the greatest poker player in the world, and the Republicans certainly don't think that Boehner is a very good poker player. They're probably both decent enough guys. Yeah, they are. I mean, I like a
stirring endorsement of the president.
Bill, is it totally impossible to think about cutting a big deal?
No, it isn't, and it could happen. I mean, I do think but as you and I were discussing this earlier, I mean, in a way, 2/3 of this deal, in part at least, has been done. Discretionary spending is capped. They did the 2011 deal, capped it much too harshly, in my view, on defense, but the discretionary spending has not gone up in the last 2 years. It's actually, for all the, after the huge stimulus, it's a higher level, but it's now flat. So you could cut it some, but you're not going to get that much more in savings from defense, and probably not really from domestic discretionary either. Taxes went up on the wealthy. We also, both parties agreed to allow the payroll tax to go back up 2% at the end of last year. Maybe there's some more tax revenues to be gotten, but you're not talking about a huge number. I think even the president's number is fairly, I don't know what it was, $800 billion now or something like that in 10 years. So $80 billion a year, it's a $3.6 trillion budget. It's not that much. So really it comes down to entitlements. And really entitlements comes down to Medicare and Medaid. Social Security is unbalanced and needs to be fixed, but actually that one could be fixed pretty easily. But the huge growth has obviously been in health care costs. And there, that's very delicate. Obamacare makes it all more complicated, obviously. Neither party has been willing. Whatever you think of the Republicans, Paul Ryan put forth a budget that did what was supposed to be politically incredibly risky on Medicare in 2011. The whole Republican Party voted for it in the House twice. Romney picked Ryan as his running mate in 2012. It didn't hurt them, in my opinion. And they voted for the same budget again this year. So I think the Republicans are willing to be serious about Medicare, but I think the scale of change you would have in Medicare and Medicaid to really save appreciable money is something Democrats just think is unwise. I don't think it's that they're politically cowardly. I just think they think this is an incredibly important program for our society, and that we've had poor economic growth, and an awful lot of people depend on this program, and we're not willing to risk the kind of change that you really need to fix Medicare and Medicaid.
But James, that takes me back to the December deal. I mean, how Democrats are not going to vote for entitlement savings without getting some revenues back. Am I right?
Well, no, they're not. What they were willing to vote for in 2011 was pretty dramatic. Let me go back I don't want to say this too loud because I might jinx it. We've had the best 3 years we've had in terms of slowing down health care costs. Why, we're not sure. But if that trend were to continue, it would be like, we're spending 18% of GDP on health care. Nobody else breaks 12. That's 6% of a $15 trillion GDP. That's a lot of money. And what Democrats like myself would say, as opposed to having a fixation on cutting Medicare, of which a lot of people depend on, why don't we think of ways to get the cost down? Now, Medicare does deliver costs cheaper than the private sector does. But, yes, but what he gave up on change CPI, that's now every budget negotiation is going to start with that. It's a complicated thing about how you figure the cost of living that's attached to Social Security, but there's some real money that comes with this. if we were able to, if healthcare costs will continue to flatten, our budget problem may not be near as serious as we think it is. Now, that's a big if. I think the weight of, if you talk to people, even Democrats will tell you that it's more likely than not in like 7 years we'll start running into some real problems that we're going to have to deal with. And but they'd say, look, between 9 and 7 years, we don't. The problems are not that big. The big problems we have is employment. I'll get into that later. But that's the overall view, is if somehow or another the health care costs continue to mitigate, we could be on a pretty good track here.
Well, I mean, wrap up this part of the show. But, I mean, what you're both saying is that since things don't seem to be that bad, that the economy, you know, I mean, the market's doing well. We're obviously lowering the deficit because of some of the steps that have been taken. Unemployment, the numbers weren't too bad. That for that reason, they really don't have to do much to deal with the budget issues that we've just talked about. I mean, that's what you're saying.
Well, I mean, I think they should do more, but they don't feel they have to do much. I mean,
There's no pressure.
Right. Neither the financial markets nor the political markets are forcing anyone or even really pressuring anyone that much toward compromise. I mean, Paul Ryan said, and he believed it, and I agreed with him in 2011, if we don't do something, we could have a debt crisis in the next 18 months. Well, there's been no debt crisis. The Fed seems to be able to continue to print money indefinitely. We're running a zero interest rate regime much longer than most people thought was possible. We're running hundreds of billions of dollars, billions of dollars of deficits every year. It's coming down some, thanks to the economy recovering some. And so far, we've paid very little price for it. So, I hate to say we have to wait till there's a crisis, but maybe you have to wait at least till the crisis seems a little more imminent. I think when interest rates start to turn up, and people really start to see what the cost of carrying that debt's going to be at a 2, 3, 4, 5% interest rate, which we're going to get back to at some point, rather than a basically 0% interest rate, I think, and if there's some kind of pressure from the bond markets, I mean, at that point, you really will have a different kind of political and economic situation than you have today. So maybe this is just kind of a weird interlude, a sort of phony war, a little bit of an Indian Spring or whatever. And I mean, look, it's harder to deal with these things if you don't deal with them earlier. I mean, I think Brian has said that over and over. You want to stop financial crises before they happen. On the other hand, it's easy for us to say that. It's harder for elected officials to do it.
Actually, no, the macroeconomics said at the beginning that you can't have high interest rates when you have the kind of demand that we have. But actually, it would be, in some extent, encouraging if interest rates went up because right. that meant that people would want more of a return on their money if they thought they could get. Right now, if you're taking 1.7 in a 10-year treasury, you're not very optimistic about growth in the long term. You're basically saying, I'll just pay the government to keep my money as opposed to put it in real estate or stocks or something like that. I actually think that QE 2 or 3 has sort of helped somewhat, and that it's kind of forcing people into real estate and into stocks a little bit, which was Milton Friedman's idea, by the way. And to some extent, it's probably been somewhat helpful. But a lot of people would say, what we need is a little inflation here. What we need is a little bit. And then if you had a little growth and that imposed some discipline on the budget, that would be fine if we had some growth. But right now, there's just the interest rate's at zero, and then there's just not as insufficient demand out there. That's been the cornerstone of macroeconomic textbooks going in there, and they've all proven to be right. They haven't been wrong about anything. The basic predictive curve has been 100% right on every issue, and that's just what it is.
Okay, we're going to turn to questions from the audience. Before that, I'd like a moment to recognize our question review team. The people who select the questions that I'll present to the speakers. And if you'll hold your applause, let me introduce the entire group. Krista Alamazan, who's the news director for KAZU Radio. Fran Gaver, the attorney with Leach and Walker, who's an old-time member of our question review team. Valentin Mendoza, who's the editor of El Sol, a Salinas, California publication. Don Miller, the editor-in-chief of the Santa Cruz Sentinel, and Philip Molnar, who's the business reporter with the Monterey County Herald. If you would give them a hand, I'd appreciate it. We also have a great group of students. They attended the afternoon program. We had a great afternoon program. I think it was close to 400 students that were there. At this time, what I'd like to do is to ask all of the students that are here tonight in attendance to stand and to remain standing as I recognize each of the schools that are present. There's about 10 schools that are represented here. So if I can get the students to stand. The students come from Cabrillo College, California State University, Monterey Bay, the Defense Language Institute, the Monterey County Home Charter School, Monterey High School, Monterey Peninsula College, the Navy Postgraduate School, San Jose State University, Santa Clara University, and Seaside High School. If you would give them all a hand. As I said, we had a great turnout on the students. It's a wonderful opportunity for students to be able to ask people questions and get into the issues that they're going to have to face in their lives. Sylvia and I, along with the Panetta Institute Board of Directors, are very grateful for the sponsorship that allows these students from high schools and colleges and universities to do that, and we want to pay tribute to the generous support that we receive from our lecture series sponsors. So thank you. Please give them a hand.